touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes! Welcome to the Scott Hall Podcast. We are back tonight consolidating our football react episode, our midweek fall slash winter sports recap episode, to one big jam-packed episode full of Cougar talk. I am going to, at the top here, try to minimize what I say because we have so much actual Cougar stuff that is certainly what you're listening for more than me stumbling through this intro, as I have done about 400 times previously. But a lot of really exciting stuff to talk about. Cougar football did not lose to Temple, and the basketball programs both got wins, both are varying degrees of excitement about that program. It's still plenty of stuff to talk about. Top 25 Cougar volleyball, of course.
I was going to say, it feels like a very two-headed decision in terms of what's the most exciting thing about Cougar athletics right now. Because, I don't know, not losing to Temple just doesn't pack the same punch as, like, men's basketball, you know, in the midst of this budding dynasty, or Cougar volleyball about to go, compete in the NCAA tournament for the first time in two decades. But, you know, excited about those two things very much. And, some other programs we're hoping to see continue to develop and build and get to that point where they're top 25 exciting teams like some of the other ones we got around Houston.
Admittedly, be a lot more somber episode here at the top if we were talking about a Cougar football loss to Temple, but a lot, as you will hear when we talk about it, a lot that maybe didn't meet our standard from that game. But gonna start positive here at the top and talk something new tonight from our good friends at the good brand homefieldapparel.com. I am really excited about this because, as much as we've been downright humbled by how many of y'all out there have used our show-specific promo code for first-time customers, I would say, as somebody who's personally a repeat home field customer, I was hoping at some point we'd get something for the many of you who we know are now satisfied home field customers who would like to maybe save a few dollars here or there being repeat home field customers. So we have for you, the listener, starting Friday, November 8th, this coming Friday, you can get 20% off everything at homefieldapparel.com. First-time customers, repeat customers, just use the promo code Black Friday altogether. New customers, repeat customer, like I said, doesn't matter. You're going to get 20% off an unbeatable collection of incredibly comfortable vintage tees and all sorts of collegiate apparel, including a really fantastic Houston Cougar collection, just by using that promo code Black Friday. This is home field's biggest discount of the year. It's open to everyone, like I have said repeatedly, and believe you me, one or both of these podcast hosts will be taking advantage of it. Just so you know, you will have from this Friday, like I said, through the Sunday after Thanksgiving, the 27th of November, to use that Black Friday promo code. So we'll be getting to the gift giving time of year. Home field tee, I would say, makes a fantastic gift, whether it's to a friend, relative, or significant other, or to yourself, no matter the school of rooting interest, or in many cases the home field, frankly, just because the shirt looks that cool. And never a bad occasion to give yourself the incredibly comfortable gift of vintage collegiate apparel. So that's homefieldapparel.com, promo code Black Friday, save that 20% and look good doing it. We're going to keep the positive vibes going here, Dustin, by talking about Houston Cougar men's basketball. Couldn't lead off with anything other than the number three team in the country, who looked pretty doggone convincing. I would, again, preface all this by saying these were two wins from the past week against teams you were expected to comfortably beat, but I think even acknowledging that at the jump, I would say those performances were still notable in a number of different ways. Wouldn't you agree, Dustin?
Oh, for sure. Very exciting to see some of the things Houston was able to do this past week. And again, like you said, you want to throw some caveats in there that you want to wait and see how this team does against some of its tougher opposition before getting too carried away. But, you know, you can only play the teams in front of you. And, you know, when you play teams like St. Joe's, Noah Roberts, there's beating those teams, and then there's beating those teams. And Houston just absolutely, clobbered both of them, made both games non-competitive, basically, from the word go. And you have to be, it's hard not to be excited about that. It's not the end goal. The end of the, end of the season goal wasn't to really clobber St. Joseph's or Earl Roberts, but, you know, the fact that Houston's able to do those things early on, I think, is indicative of why everyone is so excited about this team. And the fact that you always see Kelvin Sampson teams seem to get better as the season goes on. If you're at this point just demolishing teams, which are, not great teams, but not like bottom of the barrel. These aren't, one of the bottom 100 teams in Division I or anything like that. and Houston just comfortably beating them. Started with the 81-55 victory over St. Joseph's, a game where, yeah, Houston basically ran away and hid from the tip-off. They led 34-11 late in the first half. And to St. Joseph's credit, after, I mean, Houston only outscored them by what? I'm doing the math here, 3 points the rest of the game after that start. So, you know, I think you give St. Joe some credit that after they got their legs under them a little bit, that they were able to give the Houston Cougars a little bit more of a competitive game. But the game was well over at that point, so all they were really doing was making the final score look good. But, you know, I think the overarching story from this game has to be just the exciting breakout game from the Cougar front court. We're seeing Jairus Walker and Wani Roberts just dominate this game. Jairus Walker, you know, after, like I said, did a lot of good things, great things in the opener. Scoring the ball wasn't one of them. He turned that around in a big way. 10 of 14 shooting, just one turnover to go with his 23 points, as well as 8 boards. And then Juwan Roberts, after, you know, career high 12 points in the season opener, blew well past that with 19 points to go with his 12 boards in this one. And, you know, as just absolutely unbelievably talented, it's been, you know, well said by many people, even just national writers, how Houston has, you know, one of the best backcourts in the country this year. This was a game, but again, competition notwithstanding, seeing the front court look that good and that strong and look like they're going to give you that much this year, paired up with that backcourt that Houston's got, just makes you realize the incredible potential of this team.
Yeah, I think what was so impressive in this one is that you beat St. Joe's by 26 points, pretty much leading by double figures from the word go, with key guys like Marcus Sasser and Jamal Shedd not having a good shooting night, combining for 11 points, only making one of 11 threes between them, which isn't to say those two guys didn't have a positive impact in other areas besides their scoring, but I think this game showed that even if you have key guys like those two having off nights, which even your best players do, you have so many other good options. This is such a deep team. You cannot shut down one or two guys and still not expect the Cougars to not function at a high level. Certainly got the most from Jairus Walker. Looked like the absolute force we kind of expected him to be, finishing the game with game-high 23 points and 8 boards. Wani Roberts continuing to look like a transformed man on the offensive end. Had 19 points on a super efficient 8 of 9 from the field. And did the typical Roberts things that you would expect, like grab 12 rebounds and block 2 shots. I think, poor kid, Dustin. As soon as I saw St. Joe's Kasper Klasik on Jairus Walker, I knew Jairus Walker was going to have a big game. I knew Klasik was going to have a rough night. I was like, oh, that's Billy Legg's strategy. He's going to put this skinny European big man on Jairus Walker. And I don't want to put it all on Klasik. St. Joe's really had no answers for what Walker wanted to do inside and outside of the paint. It's not just a one-man operation there. I think if the staff would have had any quibbles with how Walker did in the opener against Northern Colorado, maybe that he settled for jumpers a bit too often for Samson's liking, and that wasn't the case here, though I think he did show off his shooting range. He did make St. Joe's pay a couple times from deep, and you did see the Cougars maybe stall out a bit offensively in the first 10 minutes of the second half. You saw St. Joe's cut the deficit to around 16-17 points, but I think credit to the Cougars, they never really let this one get too interesting. I thought it was kind of fitting, right as the Hawks were finally starting to show something close to a glimmer of life, you had that three-point play from Wani Roberts in the and one, really just extinguished any hope SJU had of making this one interesting. Tremont Mark had a really nice performance. I thought a foreshadowing of what we would see him do in the next one against Oral Roberts after having kind of a quiet opening game. And just a quick aside, I really hope that before they host this event in 2023 that the U.S. Naval Academy figures out how to pull this off without constant stoppages to mop up a sopping wet court. I think St. Joe's had a couple guys get hurt. I don't know if that was a direct result of the court being wet, but I think we could kind of breathe a sigh of relief that nobody in the Cougars got an injury playing on what was a very not safe to play on surface. I think the ultimate irony was this game was going on around the same time. I think this other game tipped off a bit later. It was going on at the same time as another game was played on a literal aircraft carrier in the ocean that did not have the amount of on-court issues that we saw from a game played in an indoor arena. Just thought it was a funny aside. I think not nearly as important as everything we've talked about with the actual game, but I thought it was just like, really? Really? We can't pull this one off?
I too was definitely relieved that no one that Houston got injured, especially when, you know, the referees multiple times pulled the coaches aside, like, you guys sure you want to finish this game? But good news about playing games in the future. I mean, they got a game in later that night, and apparently the solution was, drumroll please, they turned the air conditioning on, and that apparently fixed the problem, and Navy played somebody else later in the evening and had no problems. So
do you think some defense contractor billed like $7.5 million for that incident? I'm just kidding.
I have no doubt. I have no doubt. But no, I mean, the one last thought I had was just, yeah, seeing the big guys score up front. You know, one of the few questions I've had about this team in the offseason was just, you know, coming from having the scoring 1-2 punch in the front court of Josh Carlton and Fabian White last year, not knowing how you're going to replace those guys. This sure looks like Houston still has a pretty strong 1-2 punch offensively in their two front court starting forwards there.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it wasn't a given that after you lost Fabian White and Josh Carlton, who were very strong positives in the front court last year, that you wouldn't skip a beat. And these, I think, first few games have been quite encouraging to that end.
Absolutely. And then, as you mentioned, Houston, in the second game, comfortably defeated Oral Roberts 83-45 for the third straight game to start the season. The Cougs just jump right out to an enormous lead and put the game away right away. They've made a habit of tripling up opponents. This one, they led 36-10 before the Golden Eagles finally kind of showed up to the game. Houston led 51-24 at the half. And even after an impressive second half, start to the second half for Oral Roberts that saw them, you know, winning the second half for the first several minutes, the Cougs then closed strong. You look up, Houston won the second half by 11 points also. But yeah, definitely the story of this game. There's a lot of them, but I think the one you have to start with, what a game by Tremont Mark. 23 points on 8 of 12 shooting, just getting to the rim effortlessly. And yeah, he, you know, had, I think, what, 12 points in the win over St. Joe's, but I think it had been a fairly quiet first couple of games for him. Someone that obviously we were real excited to see what he could do this year, with everyone just absolutely crossing all their fingers and toes and hoping for him finally having a year of good health. And this just looks like the Tremont Mark that you really kind of, you know, get a little bit drooly about just imagining, you know, watching him go, because he's just so talented offensively. Someone who just, it didn't seem like anyone for Oral Roberts had any chance of staying in front of him, and someone who just can help the offense in so many different ways. I feel like he's still got room to grow in terms of his playmaking and things, but you know, he's such an ability, such a great first step, such an ability to get by guys, and just such an ability to finish at the rim. You just love his offensive game. So you know, Marcus Astor had a great game here, and I know you're going to talk about some of the youngsters here as well, including one particular big guy off the bench here. But man, it was just so exciting to see Tremont Mark playing so well offensively, and just knowing that, you know, if we're blessed enough to have a year of good health for Tremont Mark, that's the kind of performances we're going to see.
You're darn right. I got some Javier Francis thoughts here in a little bit, but yeah, I got to talk about Tremont Mark, that career 90 against Oral Roberts, 23 points, career high. And I think you saw how good he could be as a slasher. Guys like Sasser and Shed clearly have progressed a ton in their careers as slashers, that they're guys comfortable going to lane, because that's not something necessarily you easily translates from high school to college. You're going against a whole other caliber of athlete at the Division I level. But I would say those two aren't maybe naturals at it the way Mark is. And I think also a nice reminder of how automatic he is at the charity stripe. I think pretty good attribute to have when you're as good at getting to the basket as Mark is. I really thought when we previewed Oral Roberts that this was going to be a lot closer than it ended up being, which isn't to say I expect this to be down to a final possession kind of game, but I don't know. I thought Oral Roberts was a cut above the first two teams we saw, and wouldn't have been at all surprised if this had been a single-digit margin at the half. But this one followed the same pattern. The first two games, the Cougs wasted little time putting the opponent in a hole that was pretty much impossible to dig out of. I actually rewatched the first half of this one. I'd almost forgotten that this one was kind of close around the first media timeout. I think in large part because the Cougars were trying to figure out how to defend the approximately 10-foot tall Connor Vanover. I'm curious, Dustin, because it was hilarious on TV watching Wani Roberts going up against Connor Vanover. Was it as funny in person? It was shades of Breon Brady trying to match up with Taco Fall like 3 or 4 years ago.
Tragically, I last second did not make it to this game and was watching it at home, same as you. So I was left also by my befuddlement at watching Connor Vanover on the television screen.
But they went from that game being pretty close at the U16 media timeout to, over the next 10 or so minutes, the Cougs going on a 28-4 run. The kind of absurd runs that have just kind of become commonplace here early on. Oral Roberts got that first made basket in the first few minutes, was a Connor Vanover dunk, if memory serves, and did not make their second basket until we were inside 7 minutes left to play in the first half. You did see Oral Roberts' offense pick up a bit after that. Like you said, they were outscoring the Cougs for at least a bit of the second half, but when you're in that 20-something hole that early and facing this Cougar defense, it's just, you're going to be really hard-pressed to climb out of that hole. And I thought in the second half we saw some really impressive stuff from a couple guys on that second unit, those freshmen that you alluded to, Terrence Arsenault and Javier Francis. Francis I'll lead off with. Incredible that he managed a double-double in only 17 minutes off the bench. Two blocks, two steals. Clearly some things in his game that need polish, but watching some of his moves in the low post offense, I think in the season preview that I thought Francis this year would be a decent comp to Jaywan Roberts the second year in the program. And I don't believe Roberts was this advanced, at least in terms of his offensive game, in his second year in the program like Francis is. I mean, there again, still things to work on, like the poor free throw shooting, the 4,017 minutes played. But I think there's so much there to be excited about Francis. And I think, I know we're only a few games in, but maybe more things to be excited about than I expected in the preseason without having really seen much of him play against divisional competition. And what I can say about Arsenault is that he was just everywhere. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find too many possessions when he was on that the court in the second half where he wasn't involved offensively or defensively. He's a guy that could take over but is still good at getting his teammates involved. He's not a ball hog. He's still a guy that makes the right pass while still being very much involved in the action. 14 points and 5 boards to go along with the steal in those 21 minutes off the bench. Made 3 of the Cougs, 6 total 3-pointers on the night. And worth noting, the Cougars went on a 21-3 run in the second half with a lot of bench guys playing. And that's been kind of a consistent through line for these first three games, that your second unit, I would say, is as good as any we've seen since Kelvin Sampson got here. I think this was kind of a mirror image of the St. Joe's game, where you saw Sasser and Shedd struggle offensively in that one, and Jairus Walker and Jaywan Roberts picked you up. And this time, really, Walker and Roberts weren't involved offensively for different reasons. I'd say foul trouble for Walker. Roberts, I think, got a bloody nose at some point. I don't think it was anything serious, but I think he spent a lot of the second half on the bench. Shedd, early on, has kind of struggled with his shot, but it didn't matter because you have guys like Tremont Mark, Marcus Sasser, Terrence Arsenault, and Francis all being positive difference makers offensively. That, again, you could have a couple key guys have an off night, and it really doesn't matter because you have so many guys who could potentially be difference makers that it's like a hydra with lots of heads. You're just not going to have very many opponents who can cut off all the heads at once. Maybe I'm getting my mythology mixed up there, but
no, I like it. And it is, you know, even for some of the Kelvin Sampson teams that we've seen, there have been really, really impressive. There haven't always been teams that, you know, 1 through 5 in your starting lineup that you've got really just guys who can score at all five positions. You got multiple guys coming off the bench that can give you offense as well. You know, Terrence Arsenault, points off the bench here, impacting the game in a number of ways. You mentioned Javier Francis and the game that he had. And yeah, just talk about all over the court to just fill up the stat sheet like he did in playing less than half of the game is awfully impressive. And it kind of like you kind of figured coming into the year that with the guys starting ahead of him and with Reggie Chaney coming off the bench ahead of him, you go, okay, well, this is someone that we don't need to expect too much from in his sophomore year, someone who's still continuing on the development plan. But, man, I'm with you. I think he looks ahead of schedule, especially based on what we saw in the Oral Roberts game, and someone with just a ton of athleticism and a ton of size. And it, like you said, you see some of the offensive polish that's already there. Yeah, definitely has to maybe not commit as many fouls, but that's, you know, I think you're willing to take that for someone who's making as many plays all over the court as he is. If that comes with a few fouls, you're okay with that. But yeah, I mean, just overall, it's just with a team that certainly looks like they're going to continue to play defense like a Kelvin Sampson team and to rebound like a Kelvin Sampson team. The amount of offensive firepower in this team throughout just basically every guy that comes on the court is going to, you know, play his butt off on defense, is going to, you know, just play his butt off on the glass. And probably has enough offensive talent to embarrass you on the other end. So just a embarrassment of riches for this Cougar team. And they have continued to look just as strong as you can want any team to look through three games into the season.
Yeah, last night I have in this one, Oral Roberts, 45 points at Fertitta Center Monday night. Was the fewest points that the Eagles have scored in a game since their current head coach, Paul Mills, got there 6 years ago. The lowest the program has scored in a game since 2014. Before that, beating Oral Roberts in this way isn't proof positive this is an elite team. But I don't know. I think beating them as comprehensively as the Cougars did, along with everything we know about this team, is a statement unto itself. That all you can do, like you said at the beginning, is play the teams in your schedule, and the Cougars have just beaten all of their brains in, metaphorically.
Yeah, when you're showing just a ton of offensive firepower in two of your three games, you're just holding opponents to their lowest point totals in like several years to a couple of decades, then I think you may have a basketball team that's pretty good.
Pretty good.
The Cougars will try to continue to look pretty good as they host Texas Southern on Wednesday, facing their third ward neighbors for the first time since needing a buzzer beater by Daniel House in an overtime period to beat them at Hoffman's Pavilion under James Dickey in 2012, a game that was 10 years ago, but feels like it was 10,000 years ago. TSU opened the season with losses to San Francisco and Texas Tech on the road, so pretty respectable and good opponent respectively, and in both cases kept it pretty close for about 10 minutes or so, and then over the latter portion of the first half, their opponents would pull away, but then TSU hosted Arizona State, part of the Pac-12 and SWAC's Legacy Series, where a number of Pac-12 schools have been playing road games at SWAC schools, which I think is awesome. It's a gesture that I encourage the Big 12 to do something similar in the future, and Houston's there would be very supportive of that. And I say that even though the SWAC has now won three of those games, with TSU beating Arizona State in overtime, Grambling State beat Colorado a while back, and then Prairie View just knocked off Wazoo tonight. So that was first win of the season. Nice win for TSU over Arizona State. They did host Oral Roberts tonight, a game that was close for about 30 minutes before Oral Roberts continued their Houston swing in a more successful fashion by pulling away late and winning by 18 points. So, you know, that Arizona State win, I think, certainly has to jump out on the resume a little bit at you, Sam. But I think looking at the resume as a whole, you know, not... It's an Arizona State that hasn't been great under... Bobby Hurley?
Bobby Hurley, correct.
Bobby Hurley. I was worried. We saw his last NCAA tournament team, I believe,
if memory serves. You and I, when we were at Tulsa, I believe we saw his last team that went to the dance.
Yeah, and so, you know, always respect to TSU. They've pulled a number of upsets in the last several years, including that Arizona State one. But, you know, I think looking at the bulk of their schedule, including, like I said, losing by 18 to Oral Roberts tonight, tells you that maybe, you know, probably a team that Houston shouldn't be struggling too much with.
Yeah, the Tigers do have a number of veterans back from last year's team, which won the SWAC tournament and won their first four game at the NCAAs. Guys like PJ Henry, who had 22 against ASU, Jordan Carl Nichols, John Walker III, and Jordan Gilliam. And they also have some younger guys like Devon Barnes and Zatarius Mortal, who had the near the end of overtime, a game-winning shot against Arizona State, guys who Coach Johnny Jones can build around long-term. I think the big challenge for the Tigers is going to be whether they can score against this Cougar defense. This is a team that coming into the day was 297th in effective field goal percentage, 319th in two-point field goal percentage. I do think it's a veteran team that will challenge the Cougars more defensively than maybe your first three opponents were able to. But again, crazy things happen. Teams play up to the moment. Certainly, you're going to have a different level of motivation playing the number three team in the country versus Oral Roberts. But it's hard to see where TSU scores in this one. I was looking actually at the all-time series. I'm surprised that this is only the fourth time we're going to play TSU, Dustin. You mentioned the game in 2012. And before that, I vaguely remember both you and I being at a closer than expected home win over TSU around Thanksgiving in 2007. I'd memory hold Brock Heath Payne's 20-point performance from that one and all of my Brock Heath Payne freshman year hype train stuff. But three games previously played against TSU, all Cougar wins, but all closer than maybe the Cougar fandom would have liked. Maybe that's why there have only been three of these prior, but I expect this game will break the trend. I think TSU at most will keep it competitive for a half, but I think the Cougars should expect to comfortably win this one, especially TSU coming off a game the day before.
Brock Heath Payne is not a name I was expecting to hear on the podast tonight, but
it wasn't a name expect to be putting in my notes, if we're being honest.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, there's some things I like about them. You know, 5'10 senior guard PJ Henry, big breakout year, was scoring about 8.5 points a game last year, 20 plus thus far this year. Sixth year senior forward John Walker III, you mentioned him, he's a double digit scorer for the third straight year now for TSU. But just not a team that looks like they have the scoring for overall team size to keep this one competitive for 40 minutes. And then a game that Houston will have on the road against a team maybe a little bit more likely to keep it competitive. They'll be facing Oregon on the road. It will be the fourth time in five seasons that Houston and Oregon face off, with the Cougs, of course, defeating the Ducks in the opening game of the Fertitta Center. Oregon winning the return trip to Eugene the next year, and then Houston demolishing them at the Maui Jim Invitational in Vegas a year ago. And, you know, for Oregon, the good news is that, like, you know, unlike a quarter of their, Pac-12 friends, they haven't lost to a SWAC team this year. The bad news is they lost to UC Irvine at home by 13, and the final margin, zot, 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 by the way, go Eaters, rip them Eaters. And the final margin was only 13 because Oregon scored a bunch of points late when the Anteaters had that game pretty well in hand to make that game look closer than it really was. was. So, you know, looking at some of their other results, they clobbered a Florida A&M team that's one of the D1's worst in their opener. They got a Montana State team that kind of profiles a little bit similarly to Irvine in the kind of low to mid 100s, KenPom, and that I think handled them, I believe, pretty comfortably last I saw it this evening. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I think your other results maybe tell you that maybe there's a little bit of flukiness to this. But, you know, this is a team that had been coming off three really strong seasons back-to-back-to-back, but had a very down year last year. We're definitely mixing some things up and trying to kind of reshuffle and you know, rejuvenate themselves this year. And maybe not a great sign that they're going to have the bounce-back season that they want, picking up that early loss to the Anteaters.
Yeah, and UCI is a consistently good Big West program. Maybe in a vacuum,
yes,
just
to be clear, not taking any respect away from the Anteaters, who I dearly love.
And, you know, in a vacuum, losing them isn't terrible, but I think losing to them and getting absolutely manhandled the way Oregon did, having as few answers as the Ducks had offensively, coming off the season that you quite rightly, I think, described as pretty disappointing a year ago, I think it's got to be a red flag. I will say the Ducks can throw a lot of size and talent at the Cougars, and Folly Dante is a multi-year starting big man. Khalil Ware was a consensus five-star national top 10 recruit in the class of 2022, and not to mention also playing another seven-footer, Nate Biddle, and a veteran power forward in Quincy Guerrier, who the Cougs saw with Syracuse in the 2021 Sweet 16. Will Richardson, their most veteran guards, kind of been an enigma over his career. I don't think this season's been any different. He's a guy definitely capable of taking over a game, but a guy also just as capable of going totally AWOL, which he did against UCI when he went 1 of 6 from the field. One of their biggest offseason acquisitions, South Carolina grad transfer Jermaine Cousinard, sounds like he'll be out for a good deal past Sunday's game with the Cougars. So all signs there might point to this being a comfortable U of H win, but I think it's worth noting this will be a significantly tougher test than any of the first four games. The bad game against UCI, you know, put aside, this will be the Cougars' first true road environment. I would imagine, even with whatever frustrations exist in the Oregon fan base with that loss to UCI with last season, that the number three ranked team coming to town, I'm sure, will draw a good crowd in Eugene. Mentioned it previously, I'm very excited to be in person out there on Sunday for that one. I was able to find some pretty cheap flights out to Portland, thus we'll be there at Knight Arena and very excited to see what will hopefully be a nationally televised Cougar win.
Yeah, I'm really intrigued to see how this one goes. You know, I think you can trace their struggles early on, at least in the loss to Irvine, with some of the guys that I think, you know, Dane Altman probably thought he was going to get more from than he's gotten this year. You mentioned Will Richardson coming out ice cold to start the season, although he did have a 12 points and 6 assists over Montana State. And then, you know, Khalil Ware, the big five-star, 7-foot freshman, had been, you know, not terrible, but not really a major impact guy coming off the bench in their first couple of games. Also, you know, didn't maybe impact against a team like, you know, Irvine the way that you thought maybe he would. But he had, you know, big 16.7 boards tonight. So maybe, you know, if you're Oregon, this is kind of some of those pieces coming around. But this maybe is playing Montana State, and playing Montana State and playing Houston, I think, are two pretty comfortably different things. But yeah, definitely put some respect on their size. You know, we talk about the 7'5 guy for Oral Roberts, but you know, don't have a 7'5 guy, but you've got the 6'11 and the Folly Dante, the 7-footers off the bench, Ware and Nathan Biddle, like you mentioned. So that is an awful lot of size, and for a Houston team that, you know, I feel like has guarded the post really well, and it's obviously been well documented, the monster defense, what they've done guarding the post and everything like that. But like you said, this is just, it's one thing to face Oral Roberts, you know, one kind of 7-foot giant among a front court that otherwise very much could not hold its own against the Cougars. But this is a lot of big guys in that front court. They're going to be able to have multiple 7-footers on the court at the same time if they want to. They've been, no surprise, they've been blocking a ton of shots early on. I believe I saw coming prior to the KenPom game, they did not have a shot blocked in their first two games, which is pretty remarkable. They've been rebounding extremely well. So big test for the Cougar front court. And like you said, definitely a much stiffer test than the one that they faced up until this point. But, you know, if the Cougar front court can hold their own, I think I do like their chances of holding their own. I think this is a Cougar backcourt that is going to have a chance to be, you know, the strength of the Cougs in this one. Richardson struggling to start the year. Cousinard not available, like you mentioned. I think that kind of, you know, waters down the front court, or the backcourt, I should say, for Oregon. I think that is where Houston is going to have a chance to make their hay in this one.
And that was maybe my only other point, is that was my struggle when I look at an opponent, I try to talk myself into, okay, how does this opponent potentially beat this team? And all the things about the front court you said, I concur with, and I think that could be an area potentially where the Ducks get some kind of advantage, and maybe Kalel Ware really puts it all together, and Folly Dante really shows off his size and ability and all that stuff. But it's hard to see where and how the Ducks are going to be able to score against this Cougar backcourt, against guys like Marcus Sasser and Jamal Shedd and Sherman Mark, who have shown themselves to be not just difference makers offensively, but really good kind of tip of the spear, leading the defense, Kelvin Sampson guards. That's the tough part for me when how I look at this game and try to talk myself on how this opponent wins is just where the points going to come from in this Duck backcourt.
All right, Sammy, ready to switch it over to women's hoops?
Yeah, let's stick with some Cougar basketball and talk about what the women did this past week.
All right, the women's team unfortunately not having the same start to the year that the men had after opening up their season with a loss at Louisiana Lafayette. They fell on the road to New Mexico 68-61 to fall to 0-2 on the year, opening up the season with back-to-back road losses against teams that were, you know, decent but not great last year, and dropping both of them, I think, definitely a disappointing start to the season. And, you know, the New Mexico loss was a second straight game where Houston was done in by its inability to make a basket, especially from deep. After shooting 4 of 21 from beyond the arc in the opener, it got worse from there as the Cougs shot 3 of 30 on three-point attempts in this one. And, you know, I'm all for letting it fly. I'm all for, you know, the math saying that it's smart to shoot threes when you can. I'm all for giving players the green light, even if they miss a couple. But, you know, Houston wasn't a good three-point shooting team last year. Couldn't make one in the opener, and you're shooting 10% this time around. I don't know. Maybe stop shooting threes, Sam. Maybe don't hoist 30 up there. I don't know. It seems like it wasn't a winning strategy in a game that wasn't that, you know, unclose. It was a 7-point final score. It was pretty close pretty much the entire way. You know, watching Houston just shoot three after three and only making one out of every 10 was pretty frustrating.
I'm going to leave my thoughts off with a positive, and that positive is the individual performance of Tatiana Hill. She had 20 points and 11 boards. Definitely her best performance in a few seasons, certainly since her sophomore season, that breakout year in 2019-2020. And hopefully an indicator that maybe if U of H could get some of their shooting woes figured out, that Hill can also be a consistent positive difference maker in the front court, the kind of difference maker that she's flashed the ability to be at times over different points in her career. And the problem was, kind of like you said, just nothing else worked with any consistency on the offensive end. Coming off shooting 4 of 21 against ULL, the Cougars shot an even worse 3 of 30. Layla Blair and Britt Anyaje combined to make only one three-pointer, were collectively 8 of 39 from the field. And I went and watched this one in large part on the ESPN app because I wasn't able to watch live. And I'm not going to say that I assessed every single shot attempt, but I watched enough to say that it seemed like more of the same as the ULL game, that this wasn't an issue of your top guards getting the right looks, just getting off to a slow start, shooting the ball, and the shot selection just frankly wasn't that great in the first place. And I'm not going to say it's 100% bad shot selection, but this isn't a scenario also where you're getting the right looks and they aren't falling. This is not a good process, bad outcome situation. This is a questionable process, bad outcome kind of situation. And again, credit to the Cougars for hanging in there against a good opponent while not shooting better than 31% from the field in any quarter. But I would say if this team has any serious aspirations of being near the top of the American and even playing in the postseason, it just has to get better in the offensive end and fast. It was a lot of the same issues you saw in the opener, and that's maybe the frustrating part. Not even so much the loss, is that looking like you're seeing the same issues and seeing the same things that weren't working in the opener, and that you'd hope to at least split these games. You know, opening twice in the road against decent to good opponents is tough. You're going to learn more about that than playing bye games at home, but I think what you learned hasn't exactly been positive for the first three games. Still time to change that, but I think some of the same fundamental issues that we saw at the end of last year are still rearing their ugly head here at the start of this one.
Yeah, not hitting any threes, giving up a ton of free throws, not a recipe for road success. And it's another game where I think something that's kind of been indicative of this Houston team when they've struggled under Coach Huey is that, you know, you'll often see them, you know, get a decent number of steals, force a decent number of turnovers, grab a decent number of offensive rebounds, but they just also give up so many of all of those things on the other end of the court that it kind of negates their advantage. And I think that's something we saw here where, you know, New Mexico didn't shoot well. I think they were like 2 of 20 in their own right from the field in this one as well, but just, you know, got to the free throw line a bunch more times and just kind of took advantage of all the little things that Houston didn't do to pull this one out. Positively, though, the Cougar program turned things around by beating Texas A&M Commerce in their home opener, a game that finished just about an hour ago as we're recording here on Tuesday evening. Final score of 71-55. Nice to see the Cougs get to play a game at home. Nice to see them get the win. Nice to see them force the ball inside. 62 of their 76 shots in this one were of the two-point variety. Houston plus 18 on points in the paint in this one. Definitely the kind of exactly what you like to see after what we were just talking about with the previous two games. And great to see Tierra Young. Big game after a slow couple of first games for her. She scored 21 off the bench to pace the Cougs with Bria Patterson and Layla Blair in double figures as well. So, you know, A&M Commerce not going to be the big resume game that helps you out a lot, but just good to see the Cougs getting a home game and good to see them getting in the win column.
Yeah, obviously Tierra Young, the real standout performance there. Good to see Layla Blair after a couple of really difficult games to start the season, maybe getting a bit of her confidence back. I knew you'd be excited about the only 14 three-pointers attempted after the first couple games and the lack of success. From deep, also want to shout out Tatiana Hill's 15 boards as well. Certainly a noteworthy performance. Could have been even more of a blow. The Cougars made less than half of their free throws. This could have been an even more decisive win, but not too much to quibble about. The Cougs took care of business against a pretty outmatched opponent and led pretty comfortably from wire to wire in this one.
The Cougs will continue their homestand on Saturday when they host Florida State. You may remember that Houston beat the Seminoles by 10 points in Tallahassee last season against a Florida State team that actually got one of the last at-large bids to the NCAA tournament. Really good win for Houston last year. This year, Florida State 3-0 with wins over Bethune-Cookman, Kent State, and Georgia State. So maybe some strength of schedule questions there. And those last two wins notably came by just 9 and 5 points respectively. We will probably learn a little bit more in between this podcast and the game on Saturday because the Seminoles hosting Florida on Wednesday before making their way to H-Town. But, you know, real interesting matchup for the Cougs here, Sam. They have been scoring really well this year, but they have also allowed their last two opponents to make it into the 70s. So this is a team that Houston is going to have to make some shots and score some points against, Sam, if they're going to keep up, I think.
Yeah, the 89 points per game to the Noles, at least before their matchup with Florida, bringing into this one, again, probably skewed by playing a pretty bad Bethune-Cookman team in the opener, but I think it'll be an interesting match with the Cougar team that, I think if nothing else, has shown some defensive ability here early on. Their top two guards so far, freshman Tania Latson, Bucknell grad transfer Taylor O'Brien, probably the two to watch so far, combined average 43 points per game. Actually, led by a first-year head coach, Brooke Wyckoff was the longtime associate head coach under the now-retired Sue Semrau, who also coached alongside Wyckoff for a couple seasons with Ron Huey, who is an assistant on Semrau's Noles staff in his last job before he became the head coach here at the University of Houston. Certainly going to be a good test for a Cougar team that, I think if nothing else, like I said, has played good defense so far. Hopefully the home rims and maybe a questionable Florida State team defensively will be a bit friendlier. We see something like a breakout offensive game from the Cougs.
Yeah, after an underwhelming couple of road games to start the season, Houston could definitely do a lot to start pointing the trajectory of the season back in the right direction if they can beat Florida State for the second straight year. But transitioning to a program that has things very much pointed in the right direction, Cougar Volleyball continued its winning ways, continued its sweeping ways with 3-0 wins over Tulsa and Wichita State on the road this past week. Cougs with their 6th and 7th consecutive sweeps, their 16th and 17th consecutive wins as they obviously convincingly beat Tulsa and Wichita State. Cougs had a matching 25-11 laugher of a set win in each match while winning the other four sets by between 3 and 6 point margins. And, you know, really wasn't too surprising to see Houston sweep Tulsa, but the ease with which they dispatched the Shockers after Wichita had taken Houston to 5 sets at the Fertitta Center was awfully impressive and really just continues the trend that we've seen, Sam, which is that after going 10-0, you know, beating every team in the American, the second time around, teams haven't gotten closer to figuring Houston out. The Cougs have beaten them even worse and worse.
Yeah, you saw the Golden Hurricane get off to a good start in the first game. Kind of been somewhat of a pattern that we see in conference play. You're getting everyone's best shot. TU hit better in the opening set than they did in the last two. They only had one attack error, but also saw it wasn't super sustainable. Maybe you saw water find its level a bit in the final two sets. Wanted to specifically highlight from that first game, Dustin, just an absurd performance by Kate Georgiadis. 34 digs. 34 digs is a good number for a full 5-set match that goes to, you know, really, really tight finishes. To do that in 3 sets is crazy. A well-deserved America Defensive Player of the Week honor coming from that for her. Morgan Yanda also had a double-double. This is going to be an extremely difficult team to beat, I think, regardless of circumstance. I think the season has kind of borne that out. But when you have Isabel Toit and Abby Jackson both hitting 300 or better like they did on Friday, I think it's just hang on for dear life if you're the opponent. And like you said, it's been really impressive to see, not that teams get more of a book on the Cougars, the Cougars seem to be getting more of a book on their opponents, so to speak.
You mentioned K. Georgiadis, top 10 in the country, top 10 in the country in digs per set with a hair under 5.5, and she had 34 in three sets.
One. 34 would have been good for a full five-set match rather than a three-set sweep.
Yeah, really remarkable. But, you know, as much as, you know, I think Houston played well on defense, you know, K. Georgiadis, like you said, the incredible 34 digs against Tulsa, and then against Wichita State, Rachel Tullis, Cortland Henderson, and Kellen Morin all had five blocks apiece, which is another, having three different players get to five blocks in a five-setter is, in a three-setter is pretty wild also. But as much as we want to talk about the defense, Houston was just absolutely smoking offensively this past week. They hit 383 against Tulsa. They hit 326 against Wichita. Offense just running like a machine. Abby Jackson, Kennedy Warren, Isabel Toit, Cortland Henderson, just everybody putting up numbers, everybody hitting for a high percentage. You know, the Cougs just have the two-setter, multiple attacker, you know, score-from-anywhere offense running at a high level right now, and it is just a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, I should mention Kennedy Warren also had double-digit kills against Tulsa. Was really good herself. I'd actually forgotten, Dustin, when we previewed this one, Wichita State game specifically, that Wichita State was the last opponent that had taken a set off the Cougs. And then they rematch on Wichita State's home court. Cougs don't drop a single set in that one. Opening that one, hitting an absurd 519 as a team. Naturally cooled down a bit in the final two sets, but I think you saw how good the Cougs can be, even when they weren't just absolutely red hot on offense in those final two sets. You mentioned all the blocks. I think that's definitely the most impressive stat. Well, other stats stood out to me, though. Five different Cougars against Wichita State had at least three digs, which I think speaks to the consistently excellent team defense that we've probably almost taken for granted, and certainly not a small part of why this team is as good as they are. K. Georgiadis, excellent. One of the best liberos in the country, but it has to be a team effort. It can't just be Kate Georgiadis, and that you had the Shockers play a clean game and still get swept in their home court by this Cougar team. Just an absolute feat. What was, I think, probably debatable with the upcoming home game against SMU, your second toughest remaining game, with obviously the road trip to UCF and the finale looming, and the Cougars really, other than the final two sets being close-ish, didn't really ever let the Shockers back in this one.
As the Cougs will look to stay hot this coming weekend, well, they will host Memphis and SMU in their final home matches of the year. Cougs looking to close the season with a perfect 14-0 record from the friendly confines of the Fertitta Center, hosting Memphis on Friday evening at 7, SMU on Sunday afternoon at 1. And, you know, these are two teams that are in the top half of the American Athletic Conference standings, but I think also two teams that Houston, especially at home, you know, shouldn't expect maybe too much of a struggle against, because the AAC is so top heavy. You know, I say Memphis, they're, you know, sole possession of fifth place out of 11 teams, but they're able to do that despite being just 7-9 in conference play because the conference is so top heavy. When these two teams faced off in Memphis, it was a Cougar sweep, but all three sets were decided by just 2 points. And if you're thinking, well, they played pretty Houston pretty close there, it is worth noting they've lost four straight matches, including losses to ECU, Temple, and South Florida, three of the bottom four teams in the conference standing. So I think a match that Houston should expect to do real well. And then SMU, you know, clear third best team in the American. They've won every match against every team not named Houston or UCF, but, you know, lost 3-0 and 3-1 to UCF in their two meetings against the Knights. Houston swept them in Dallas. You know, if someone's going to give Houston trouble this week, it will almost certainly be SMU. They did just take a set off of UCF in Orlando a couple weeks ago. Their last six matches against the non-U of H, non-UCF tier of the conference have all been sweeps. But like I said, they've looked clearly the second best team in all three matches against the teams better than them in the conference this year. And facing Houston in the Fertitta Center does not feel like a recipe for changing that.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a weird, way to look at it, but Memphis, I would say, probably had the closest 3-0 sweep that the Cougars have played this season. That the Cougars won all three, but I watched that game. Every single set was a nail-biter. Memphis gave the Cougs... Really, Memphis, I think, had set point in two of those three sets, but the Cougars came back and won. So certainly an opponent that gave the Cougs some problems early, though like we talked about earlier, we've seen the pattern of this team looking better their second time facing an opponent rather than vice versa. And yeah, SMU, got to point out, I think it's pretty wild. They have only lost to U of H or UCF in conference play, though in those three losses, like you said, definitely looked like the second best team. I think an appropriate opponent for Senior Day. We'll get on my soapbox here a little bit and say, if you have not done so already, please get out to Fertitta Center. This is the best volleyball team in almost 30 years. This team is a blast to watch. You're going to pretty much get guaranteed one of the nicest seats in the house at the Fertitta Center. The seats that us commoners may not be able to normally snag for Cougar men's basketball, you can get those for a pretty cheap price to see one of the best volleyball teams in the country, a team certainly worthy of your support. But if you're listening to us, you're probably someone inclined to already do that. So I will promptly get off my soapbox here.
All right, Sam, we've talked hoops, we've talked volleyball.
We have no choice but to talk Cougar football.
All right, we'll talk about a Cougar team that, I mean, we're talking about them in these terms, and they technically won this past week as they beat Temple 43-30. I was there. I saw them. They won 43-36, a win over the Temple Owls. But a game that, you know, I think, as you can probably judge by our tone of voice, and as you probably well know if you watch the game, pretty uninspiring. You know, just the offense continues to look strong. You know, Clayton Toon continues to throw the ball well. That receiver core continues to look fleshed out beyond just Tank Dell, with guys like Sam Brown and Matthew Golden, who, you know, you can actually pretty comfortably predict will be back next year, looking really strong. Stacey Sneed continues to look like one of the pleasant surprises of the year at running back. But Sam, the defense struggling that much, and you know, having to wait that long into this game to really put away Temple, not exactly the win that's going to you know, get I think the average fan jumping back on the bandwagon.
Certainly not. And, you know, can acknowledge that the sum total of this one was another good offensive performance from the Cougars. Was, unfortunately, another slow start from the Cougar offense. And as we'll get to, a defensive effort with pretty few clear positives. The Cougars, I will do my usual and talk about how the Cougars eventually won this one. Won the coin toss, elected to defer, gave Temple the ball in the opening possession, which they promptly went 10 plays and 79 yards to score the game's opening touchdown. And looked like the Cougars were going to emphatically respond, but the Owls picked Clayton Toon in a pass that so obviously should have been a touchdown reception that I'm kind of mad that that officially counts as an interception on Clayton Toon's ledger. But unfortunately, the ball went off Keshawn Carter's hands and into the, I'm sure, very surprised and grateful clutches of Temple defensive back Maheem McCargo. Don't know if you're going to find an interception in all of FBS football this year that was less the fault of the quarterback throwing it. Cougar defense did stop the Owls on a fourth down near midfield. Cougs got the ball there for their first touchdown drive, capped off by a short Stacey Sneed touchdown run. On the next kickoff, Noah Guzman forced and recovered a fumble by the Temple return man. The Cougars took advantage of that short field to score a touchdown and go up by a score, where Clayton Toon called his own number for a rushing touchdown. Unfortunately, the Owls would score twice in the final 6 minutes of the first half. The Cougar defense struggled to do anything to stop quarterback E.J. Warner in the Temple passing attack, though Temple did get one of those touchdowns on a fourth and long fake field goal that I thought this was the most hilarious irony, Dustin, that the fake field goal touchdown was followed by a missed PAT. Just an absolute contrast of special teams outcomes there. If not for that missed PAT and an odd and ultimately unsuccessful decision to go for two on their second quarter touchdown, the Cougars would have gone to halftime, allowing Temple to have exceeded their full season scoring average in just two quarters of football. I guess, thankfully, the Cougar offense was a lot stronger in the second half. Didn't punt once, scored on four of their five second half possessions. Stacey Sneed had a really nice touchdown run to open the second half scoring. Toon threw touchdown passes subsequently to Christian Trahan and, of course, Tank Dell. And I thought in particular, even though this guy didn't have a touchdown reception on the day, I did want to highlight Sam Brown because I thought he had a number of critical catches in this one, really allowed the Cougar passing offense to flourish whenever Toon couldn't connect with Tank Dell. Unfortunately, the Cougar defense wasn't much better in the second half than they were in the first. They did allow the offense to get in the driver's seat a bit. They did get Temple off the field on fourth down for the second time in the game in the Owls' third quarter opening drive, but they also allowed three different scoring drives of 70-plus yards in the second half. Looked pretty powerless to stop the Owl passing attack, which just ate the Cougar defense alive on underneath passes. The game really got hairy in the fourth quarter after a Stacey Sneed fumble on what really should have been the game icing drive, gave Temple the ball back with 6 minutes left, the Owls marched down the field, took their first lead since halftime with a fourth down EJ Warner touchdown pass to Zay Baines. At that point, with 1 minute and 22 seconds left in the game, the Cougars were really staring down a humiliating loss, but thankfully, 5 plays later, Clayton Tune finds Matthew Golden, who laid out for a spectacular touchdown grab. Cougs took the lead for good. UH was able to get the ball down to the Cougar 25, but time expired. The Cougars were able to just see out their sixth win of the season in an unexpectedly close fashion. Dustin, where do you want to start with this one?
I mean, I don't think there's anywhere to start other than just talking about, you know, for a second straight week, how woefully incompetent the Cougar defense looked. EJ Warner threw for nearly 500 yards. The Cougs got just one sack against 59 pass attempts. You know, against a team that had scored more than 20 points 3 times all year, once against an FCS team, once against the worst FBS team, and once against a team that was so embarrassed that they fired their coach afterwards. You know, nobody else conceded more than 20 points to Temple, and they scored 36 against Houston, and it felt like they could have and they should have scored more than that. It is just a, you know, you barely notice the difference between a really good SMU offense just historically torching this this Cougar defense and what Temple did. The 36 points, I thought, flattered Houston significantly. This was a game that didn't have that many drives. They're really maybe like 2 drives the entire game where Houston stopped 2 or 3 where Houston stopped Temple.
Yeah, the two fourth down stops I mentioned.
I mean, like, that's... I don't know. Just it's getting harder and harder to explain or excuse this this Cougar defense, which just continues to seemingly melt in front of us to a further and further extent each week.
I would even go further than you. I would call the defensive performance that we saw on Saturday catastrophically bad. And yes, SMU scored 77 points. Technically, you did a little bit better than that. But if you were looking for some kind of sign that this defense was going to go out there and look different, play with a different kind of wounded pride or whatever you want to call it after the performance that we saw in Dallas, I don't think you saw anything close to that, because like you pointed out, the SMU game, a lot higher possession one than this one, and that, again, if you want to exclude Temple, I guess you can't exclude, they did get the ball with 1 minute left to end the second quarter. That's enough time to theoretically score, but just they didn't have a single punt in this game. They didn't have any, and they didn't have any drive where, other than maybe that first quarter one, they were near midfield. But quite honestly, if you have fourth and not a mile against this Cougar defense, why would you play? It seemed like the later it got in the down the distance, the longer the down distance to go, the less confidence I had. It would be last year we would have an opposing offense in like 3rd and 6th and longer, and I wouldn't say I got overly confident, but I would start to think, okay, we're going to be able to get them off the field here. They're not going to be able to convert anything other than a short distance against us. And the longer the distance, it's almost like, good Lord, what's our secondary going to do in this one? And I know EJ Warner is probably coming into this one at a high point confidence-wise, because he did have a really fantastic game against USF, and it's different facing a guy coming off a really good performance than it is maybe starting his first or second game like you did early in the season. But, I mean, 486 yards, it speaks for itself. I don't think there's anything positive you could say about a true freshman quarterback. A true freshman quarterback who really hasn't shown the ability to be a consistent game changer against anything approaching a good team this year, almost throwing for 500 yards against you. I mean, it's just one humiliation after another with this defense. And I've tried not to be a prisoner of the moment. I've tried not to overreact. I've tried not to maybe not try to see a long-term vision that this defense is building towards, but I think we could say now 10 games in that this is a terrible defense. This is as bad as any defense as you and I have seen in our 15, 16-ish years following this program closely. This was, I would say, the only difference between this defense and the 2018 defense that ended their year catastrophically bad is that this team occasionally shows, I would say, promise as a run defense, can occasionally get pressure on opposing quarterback, but really weren't effective at getting pressure in this one. 1 sack to 59 pass attempts. I know Temple did a good job designing it so that EJ Warner was getting the ball out of his hands quickly, but if Temple can figure out a way to pass for almost 500 yards with a true freshman quarterback who came into the year as the team's third stringer, I mean, what's to say Dustin Holton, and not to get ahead of ourselves and talk about the game that's coming up, what's to say Holton Ahlers doesn't throw for 700 fucking yards in Greenville against this defense. I'm sorry. It's just, it's inexcusably bad. It is a, you know, I know we expected some regression, but this is not, I think, the level of regression that's acceptable. This is just a painfully bad defensive performance, overshadowing what I thought was a strong performance from Clayton Tune and the offense. That Clayton Tune did what he did, that Stacey Sneed had one of the better individual running back performances we've seen under this coach, really, in his entire 4 years here, and that you and I are leading off talking about the defense and how bad the defense has been. I think that just speaks to how much oxygen this bad defense is kind of taking up with the discourse around this team.
Yeah, it's going from one of the top 2025 best defenses in the country, one of the top 2025 worst defenses in the country. Pretty jarring, actually. Pretty jarring. And yeah, like you said, you know, we both mentioned it, one sack on 59 pass attempts. And as much as you'd like to go, okay, well, a lot of that was, you know, Temple getting the ball out of Warner's hands real quickly. That also just means that, man, your secondary couldn't defend anybody even for the, like, second and a half that they needed, you know, to, like, get the ball out of Warner's hands. Like, that just means that also he threw for dang near 500 yards on a bunch of, you know, short little quick balls that you couldn't, even guard your receivers for a little bit, you know, let alone long enough to let your you know, sack avenue get to the guy. So it just, yeah, I don't know. And again, you like to give the defense credit for some injuries, but man, this is just the amount of regression. Just it seems to be more than what could be attributed to just injuries. It's more than, I think, you to just say, oh well, Doug Belk was overrated or whatever. It's just, I think you have to throw a lot of explanations there all together, and you're still kind of, I think, scratching your head trying to come up with the balance of how this defense got this bad this quickly.
And I don't think Doug forgot how to coach defense in a year's time, or that last year was totally a fluke. I don't believe that, but whatever's happening between Sunday and Saturday just isn't adding up to anything other than just a really terrible defense.
Yeah, like you mentioned, if you're looking for reasons to be positive, Clayton Tune continuing to throw the ball really damn well. You know, and it's that Matthew Golden catch, man. That Matthew Golden catch right at the end. That catch deserves better, right? You got a true freshman absolutely laying out to make the catch on just a beautifully thrown deep ball to get the team the finally doing what the other team's been doing to us all year, which is letting us take the lead in the last minute or so and then immediately marching down the field and getting the go-ahead touchdown, scoring a little bit too quickly almost. And then that catch just deserves so much better as a spectacular, breathtaking, game-winning catch that just, you know, as at the game on Saturday was one that really, you know, for TDECU Stadium crowd that has had a hard time really getting excited, both due to the small numbers of people there and due to the small number of exciting, excitement-worthy plays and games that there have been. That was a real nice moment to see, you know, for a brief minute there. It was like, everyone was like, holy crap, what a catch. That was remarkable. Great play by Matthew Golden. Hopefully portends a lot of future dramatic catches in his future, but it was hard not to pretty quickly remember that you needed that remarkable catch to not lose to Temple, which is a bad team. So it's kind of, any trying to focus on the positives, it's hard to really stick there too long before you come crashing back down to earth.
Yeah, shout out to Tank Dell as well. Crossed 1,000 receiving yards for the second straight season. Pretty much a lock to, for the third straight year, lead the Cougs in receptions and receiving yards. Had a touchdown in this one, and I thought, I mentioned earlier, Sam Brown, I thought, did a really nice job. Did not have a touchdown grab, but did a really nice job. Had a couple critical third and fourth down catches in this one. Really allowed the Cougs to move the sticks. And like you said, that spectacular Matthew Golden catch deserves a different kind of context than, oh yeah, it was a great catch in you just barely not losing to Temple, the, I think, pretty well-established second-worst team in the conference. And Stacey Sneed, shout out to him too, man. 11 carries, 143 yards, some really nice runs. I'm glad for the win for a lot of reasons. I think starting with that you didn't lose to this very not good Temple team, but I'm glad that we're not talking about this game and the loss being, at least in some secondary way, a result of that Stacey Sneed fumble, because I thought the performance deserved better, and I was just hoping that wasn't going to be the narrative, if nothing else, that fumble playing a larger part in this loss, because I really think these last few weeks, he's shown himself to be as much of a difference maker at running back as any player not named Alton McCaskill has been for you since Dana Holgorsen has gotten here. That I think you could say it's against some of not the best opposing defenses, and I don't think it's still been consistently good yet, but that you've seen, I think, more from the running game this past month and some change, and I think Stacey Snead being a big part of that, reason to be excited. I think mentioned it last episode that obviously a lot of question marks in a post-Clayton Tune Cougar offense, but you feel a little bit better if you know that whoever is going to be your quarterback in this post-Clayton Tune era is going to have difference makers like Sam Brown, Matthew Golden, Stacey Snead, Alton McCaskill, and hopefully a healthy Brandon Campbell as well. So positives definitely offensively, and I think frustrating that we had to give the offense second billing because the defensive performances just continue to be so bad.
Yeah, we've talked about it a lot, you know, this past year or so about, in early on in this, Cougar Athletics year, we talked a lot about getting Big 12 ready. Well, you've got two games plus, got bowl eligibility, so plus a bowl game, I guess, before this is a Big 12 program. And I think this game highlighted both the exciting and scary aspects of this, right? You know, Stacey Snead being part of a running back core with, Alton McCaskill and Brandon Campbell heading into the Big 12 next year, exciting. Matthew Golden, Sam Brown being part of the receiving core heading to the Big 12 next year, exciting. Even if you're having to find a new quarterback to throw balls to them. A defense that was struggling mightily to get any kind of stop against Temple heading to the Big 12 next year. Less than exciting. So, it's a win. You got to 6-4. I think that 6-4 mark kind of, it's hard not to, take a minute back and remember getting bowl eligible 10 games into the season was certainly not the expectation or the grade that, I think the fans, the administration, or the coaching staff or the players wanted to be grading the season by this year.
And I'm happy this team at least cleared that bar of bowling. And I don't want to say too much bad about the team globally with an offense that genuinely was a lot more good than bad on Saturday. It's genuinely been a lot more good than bad for the last month, some change, but I don't know. How can you be positive about winning at a good, hungry ECU team here this coming Saturday, or just positive about the long-term prospects of being a Big 12 program when we're having as bad of a defensive season as any of the really bad seasons that we've seen in the past 10, 15 years? How can a defense that was so good a year ago not just regress, because I think we expected some regression there, but look like one of the country's worst defenses in just a year's time? But with all respect to Temple, if this team was the team that we expected at the start of the season, this one should have never been close. I think the offense held up its end of the bargain, but obviously defense, not so much. And like you said, getting bowl eligible by your 10th game was probably not what this team was hoping for at the start of the season.
All right, Sam, we ready to move on to some forward reviews?
Let's do it.
All right, we had some people finding the silver linings, and happy with the win. Nate had this win was golden. One of a few people that had some golden puns in there after that great catch. Wendy says, finally, we're bowl eligible. And Nick was happy, saying, Tune saves day again. But definitely some people a little bit worried about the defense as well. Renee asks, what is a defense? Philip had Sack Avenue Road closed. Ray says, pass defense is non-existent. And Dan had, on defense, turn channel.
MKE Cougar, I think, summed up the entirety of my Temple game thoughts in four words pretty well. He had, win good, period, defense bad. The Freshest Prince also had Samson for defensive coordinator. With all respect to Freshest Prince, I think we need to keep him over there with the basketball team. Our good friend Bill had, bowl eligibility, which I could read it as cheerful or sarcastic. I think that's why it's good. It works there. A couple other Clayton Tune ones. Mark had, thank God for Tune. Coug 57 had Clayton the Man Tune. And another golden one that I liked was Parker had, hometown hero is golden. Like that one a lot.
Blake succinctly notes, too close for comfort. I also am one of my favorites, the win good defense matters. I had the one on there as well. And then finally, a couple of just kind of understated ones that I want to end on, at least for mine, that I think just kind of correctly understated what the win actually really was. Manuel just said, beat Temple by 7, which I think is a, that's how'd you do? You beat Temple by 7. It's, you won, but you also beat Temple by 7. And finally, Jim had, well, it's a win.
Yep.
It is technically a win. I mean,
it is a win. I cannot take that away. I could not argue with that.
I challenge you to tell me it wasn't a win, Sam. You can't. It was a win. All right. Let's stop being sarcastic about the Houston win and look around the rest of the country from this past week. Starting with, certainly, I think, and this is relevant, we'll talk a little bit about maybe more as we talk about Houston's next week opponent here. But I think the interesting week started on Friday with East Carolina traveling to Cincinnati. Really close game that saw Cincinnati take the lead in the first half. ECU coming back with 13 unanswered points in the third quarter with two-point conversion attempting to help them out there, failing, and then Cincinnati in the fourth quarter getting the field goal, short field goal, to take a 27-25 lead, ultimately held on and withheld ECU for that 27-25 win. But, if you're Cincinnati, I guess you're happy to get the win at home and stay in the middle of that conference race. But and in East Carolina, it's been, up and down season. I'm sure they would have loved to get the W there and kind of get that exclamation point, but I think very indicative of the fact that this team that we're playing next Saturday on the road, Sam, is pretty good and is hanging right there with some teams that are doing a lot better than us right now.
Yeah, it seems like it follows the pattern of a number of ECU losses here in that they played it incredibly close and then somehow inexplicably found a way to lose. I think if you're looking for one way that this Cincy team is a cut below last year's team, which, again, I think is not a bad place to be considering the absurd amount of talent they lost off of last year's team, but only rushing for 66 yards against the conference opponent was just not something you saw with any regularity the past few years, the Bearcats under Luke Fickell, which, again, that's a credit to ECU having a good defense, which we'll get to, but just not something the Bearcats have done as well as they've done previous years, and I think maybe kind of an indicator of where that program is now versus where they were maybe the previous 3 or 4 years.
Getting into Saturday's game, some of the Saturday morning games, kind of a surprisingly close one. A game that I don't think we even mentioned in our preview last week, so I didn't expect it to be too close, but Navy hosting Notre Dame actually looked kind of well out of this one, but held Notre Dame without a point in the second half as they attempted to make the comeback, ended up falling just short, losing 35-32. And I guess it's been a Notre Dame team that's been very hard to decipher this year, so it's hard to know what to make of that. But it's a Notre Dame team that seemed like they was playing some of its best football in recent weeks, having just beaten Clemson by 3 scores the week prior. So, no moral victories when you're losing to fall to 3-7 on the season and aren't really competitive at all in your conference race yet again. But surprisingly competitive result for Navy against Notre Dame there.
Yeah, Navy is such a weird team to figure out. I mean, they're 3-7 in the season, so I guess you could say they're kind of the typical, other than 2019, last several years of Navy football, not being a terribly good team, but they beat this, I would say, fairly good ECU team that we're about to see this coming weekend and really put a scare into Notre Dame. So it's just kind of hard to figure out where they are, and I think with the program, I don't know, maybe potentially looking to make a decision after the season, I don't think the kind of up and down nature of the midshipman football team this year has made that any easier.
I did want to mention the big conference matchup from Saturday, which was certainly UCF at Tulane, the Knights pulling off the 38-31 victory. We've kind of talked about throughout the season being real interested in their quarterback situation, going back and forth between John Reese Plumlee, the senior grad transfer from Ole Miss, and then Mikey Keene. And Reese Plumlee back out here for this one. And as much as the last couple of weeks, I kind of said, it seems like they're kind of finding their feet with Keene. Maybe they're ready to embrace the present and the future, the guy that's got a couple more years of eligibility. But Plumlee was back in the starting reins in this one and looked awfully impressive. Still not throwing for a million yards, but ran for 176 and a couple of scores in this one as they put up 38 points on a pretty good Tulane team and gave the Green Wave just their first conference loss of the season. So it continues to be a UCF team that just is resilient and impressive and seems to have an awfully high floor, even when not everything goes right for them in a given season. And I think that continues to be the case with a nice win over Tulane here.
Yeah, I think the frustrating thing if you're Tulane is that the run game was working. Tyjae Spears had 8 carries for 130 yards, but you were in such a hole so early that you couldn't really run the ball like probably Willie Fritz and his offensive brain trust would normally like to do. And conversely, UCF had a really good day running the football. I mean, John Rhys Plumlee's offensive stat line his passing stat line is not that impressive, but offensively, I mean, we're talking about a guy who had almost 10 yards a carry there. And I think really was the engine that made that Knights offense go. I think if you're a UCF fan, if you have one quibble, it's that you were really out to a big early lead there and kind of let the Green Wave hang around longer than maybe you have liked. But I think if you're a UCF fan, this was one of those any win is a good win situation. This was a big, big game for Tulane. And I think now the win puts UCF pretty clearly in that driver's seat to get to the AAC championship game for the first time since 2019.
Certainly a game from our future conference wanted to talk about as well, as TCU stays undefeated with a 17-10 win over the Longhorns. Game that was played in Austin. And man, as much as, there's been a lot of talk this year about, Quinn Ewers and that Longhorn offense. This was a team that did not score in the first half. 3-0 halftime score. A game that I saw a lot of people talking about maybe being a fairly high scoring game. You know, the over under was 64.5, so expecting both teams in the 30s. And, we had to have a couple of late touchdowns just to get even to a 17-10 final. But love seeing the Horned Frogs stand defeated. You know, they've been winning by getting in all these shootouts all this year, so kind of funny to see them winning a 17-10 final score. But, happy for them to stay 10-0 and, for our future conference as seeks to get a team into the playoff. It seems like the Horned Frogs are the one last great hope, so happy to see them get the W there. Obviously, never sad to see the Born Dorn school take an L.
Certainly not. And I think if you're really going to be a top of the country kind of team, you're going to have to win games a variety of ways. You can't just be a team that wins shootouts for 12 regular season games. You're going to have to win some ugly ones, and TCU definitely won an ugly one, and I think really impressive, and it proves, I think, that Sonny Dykes is no longer just an air raid, win games by scoring 50, 60 points kind of coach. I think he's adapted really well to this roster, and I think made an absolutely brilliant hire upon getting to Fort Worth in Joe Gillespie, who had been the defensive coordinator at Tulsa. I don't think it's a coincidence that he really has made a positive impact on that TCU defense, and that Tulsa, I think, is worse for his absence as well.
The only other game that really caught my eye, that was kind of in the late night slot here, and that was Arizona with a weird 34-28 win at UCLA, a game that I was just not anticipating going that way at all. And I'm not, not paying too much attention to the Pac-12 this year, but I do know that UCLA having a real strong season, Arizona continuing to really struggle. I think their only previous Pac-12 win had been over Colorado, who's just like historically bad this year. So I got, saw a customer this week who was a big Arizona fan, always wearing Arizona gear, and got to congratulate him and see the absolute shock as in his face as he talked about his team somehow beating what had looked like a pretty good ranked Bruin team.
Yeah, it was a UCLA team that looked kind of vulnerable at times. I mean, they had some good wins in there, but this is a team that also almost lost at home to South Alabama. Not really a great defensive team, though. A pretty good offense with Dorian Thompson-Robinson. And that Arizona hadn't been that good this year, but had at least shown, I think, a pretty strong pulse on offense with Jaden Deloria. So not going to say I called the upset, but happy at myself for at least highlighting that one as a good late night game to watch. Not going to spend a ton of time on this one, but I second screened Washington, Oregon, and I found that one to be a pretty wildly entertaining game. Another game where the home team might have scored a bit quickly, and Washington had just enough time to kick the game-winning field goal and win that one.
All right, are there any other games from this past week? It felt like not that many games that I really had notes down to talk about. Did I miss any of the good ones, or was it just a couple, kind of an underwhelming week?
Yeah, I would agree with that. A couple quick notes here. Again, weird to end this on two SEC things, but I think you'll understand why I had them. Vandy breaking an SEC losing streak that back to 2019 by beating a top 25 Kentucky team in Lexington. You're going to give the Doors their flowers. That was pretty impressive. And our neighbors about an hour and a half to the northwest, A&M, officially bowing out of even having a chance of being bowl eligible with a 13-10 loss to Auburn and interim coach Cadillac Williams. You just really hate to see it, Dusty. You really hate to see it, and that this 3-7 team has a coach with an $85 million buyout. Just truly hate to see that for the Aggs.
Tragic stuff, for sure. All right, let's turn our attention forward to Houston's final ever American Athletic Conference road game, as they will be taking on East Carolina on Sunday afternoon. Hey, you know what type of team you'd rather not face when your pass defense can't seem to stop anybody? Probably a team with a veteran quarterback who's thrown for almost 3,000 yards already this season, and whose coach will have no hesitancy, I imagine, about letting him put it in the air 40-plus times a game. Oh, hey, hey, look, here comes Holt Naylor's and the ECU Pirate team, and it's a team that, like I said, they've had some ups and downs. They've definitely had some games where they probably, should have won and were able to just find ways to lose. But I don't know, Sam. My initial gut reaction from looking at this team and looking at how much success they've had passing the ball and what a talented veteran quarterback Holton Ahlers is, is my impression is that they might not it might not come down to one or two plays right at the end of the game, because I feel like ECU looking like a team playing significantly better right now than the Cougs are.
Yeah, I would agree with that. In a different way than the Cougars, ECU has found a way to be a vexing team with a 6-4 record. Three of those four losses have come by incredibly tight margins. They lost their home opener against NC State. NC State at full strength, mind you, in a game where even average place kicking would have led to a Pirate win. Lost in overtime by a field goal at home to a Navy team that we mentioned earlier has been kind of hot and cold. Lost an extremely tight game to Cincy this past Friday. Really the only loss that wasn't a close one was losing by a couple touchdowns at Tulane back in October. They also needed four overtimes at home to beat a not very good Memphis team. But this ECU team also completely pounded a good UCF team just a few weeks ago in Greenville, won in Provo over BYU, which I think is impressive no matter what kind of BYU team is out there. So I would say certainly Mike Houston's best team since he took over ECU before the 2019 season, miles better than the kind of product we saw under Scotty Montgomery 4, 5, 6 years ago. But I think taking that next step has been elusive for a team that I would say coming into this year maybe didn't have the, Group of Five NY6 representative, be the Cincinnati of 2022, which was kind of the word coming out of the Cougar camp this year. But I would imagine ECU wanted to be better than 6-4 at this point in the season. But even acknowledging that, I agree with you. Certainly a team looking like they're playing better football than the Cougars. It feels like Holton Ahlers has been their quarterback since the dawn of time. That offense has had their moments this year. Seeing what they did to UCF a few weeks ago, a UCF defense that I think is much better than this Cougar defense, doesn't give me the greatest feeling. But I would imagine what's frustrating for Pirate fans is that this offense is generating over 460 yards a game, Dustin, and yet they're only averaging a hair under 32 points. I know that's a pretty basic couple of stats to look at, but I was trying to rack my brain to figure out how do you generate close to 500 yards per game and only 30-something points. And I mean, it's not a turnover issue. They only have 5 interceptions and 2 lost fumbles today, but they're definitely a pass-first offense. But even without Rajai Harris, one of their two-headed monster from running back last year, they have still improved running the ball over last year. Their offensive line, I think, has critically done a lot better job protecting Ahlers than they did last year. I would say some of that also is Ahlers doing a better job knowing when to get rid of the ball, being more aware of opposing pass rushers, a guy who I think has always had the mobility. It was just about, I think, getting the clock in his head and all that right. And you know, that's been really the biggest bugaboo. It seems like they've solved it, which I think probably makes it even more frustrating that their offense has run hot and cold so much this year. And I think what scares me the most about that passing attack, and like you said, their willingness to throw the ball, is that it's not a one-headed monster in that passing attack. They have two proven effective receivers they can go to, Isaiah Winstead and CJ Johnson. So even if, and it's a big if here, Ahlers can't find Winstead or Johnson, you know, he has the other guy to go to. And I gotta say, if Temple can throw for nearly 500 yards with a true freshman quarterback on an offense that over there, you know, for the Owls has had limited success in the current season, I mean, what's ECU going to do with a fifth-year starting quarterback with a proven supporting cast of guys around him? Probably not good stuff if you're a Cougar fan.
Yeah, when you look at, I think, that yard versus point kind of imbalance that you mentioned, I think what that says to you is it's a team that maybe is moving the ball well but having trouble finishing drives. This does not look like a Cougar defense capable of frustrating an opposing team in terms of not being able to finish drives right now. So I think if you're an offense that can move the ball but can't finish the drive, then this Houston defense right now is looking like the absolute best thing for you, which is, not giving me a ton of confidence heading into this one. And then, I don't know, the other thing that kind of jumps out to me is that, you know, I kind of hate to bring this up because I make a point to not try to overreact to, single game results from, you know, two teams and assuming that means anything about how the matchup is going to go next year, because it's, it is ultimately just one data point of 12 last year, and it's not any more indicative of how good a team that you had last year than any other game that you played is. But this is an ECU team. I must say all that and put all that aside, and then nonetheless look at last year's game when this ECU team gave Houston a very hard time at the stadium with their name on it. In Houston, they took the Cougs to overtime in that one, and in the year since, Houston has gotten worse as a team. ECU, while it's been an up-and-down year like we talked about, I think they've gotten better on both sides of the ball than where they were last year, and the game shifts from TDECU Stadium to one of the premier home field advantages in the American Athletic Conference, if not college football as a whole. So, you know, I guess this is, you know, I feel like that's when you're, like, perfectly set up to be, you know, pleasantly surprised by a team, is when it seems like everything is pointing wrong, and then Vegas says, no, I only see this as a 5.5-point game. Sees this as a, you know, one score, one possession type of game. But, man, it's hard for me to even match Vegas's optimism as I'm just looking at this game, looking at this matchup, you know, and trying to figure out, you know, how to have some confidence about it.
And we're not narrative guys, but I don't know, Dustin. Look at this one. This is Holt Naylor. Should be his last ever home game for his hometown school. Just feels like a recipe for a bad, bad record-setting performance kind of game. I mean, and I realize this ECU offense has been up and down, but I think it's fair if you're a Cougar fan to feel, you know, feel hard-pressed for much confidence that this defense is going to offer much resistance against any offense with a pulse. And I would argue that this Pirate defense is also the best unit the Cougars have seen since the conference opener against Tulane. And I would say, certainly recently, your best test of whether or not this Cougar offense's resurgence that we've seen post that Tulane game, really probably since the fourth quarter against Memphis, is genuine proof of things being heading in the right direction, or just you facing a string of not very good to okay defenses. And, you know, like last year, the Pirates do a pretty solid job of getting after the quarterback, 25 team sacks in 10 games played so far. And I think what's impressive is they're doing it while losing some key guys from all levels off last year's defense, guys like Jaquan McMillan, Warren Saba, and Bruce Bivens. The most points the Pirates have allowed to a conference opponent was 30 in regulation to Memphis. I'm not going to hold their four overtime point total against the Pirate defense. They've allowed some opponents to throw for a good amount of yards, which I guess is a good sign for this Cougar offense that's had a pretty good passing attack. Lately, though, they have 9 interceptions as a team to this point. I think the biggest test will be whether or not the Cougs can generate any kind of a run game against a Pirate defense that has held 4 opponents this year to under 100 yards rushing. I think collectively in the whole has been quite a good run defense. You know, if you'll recall when these teams met last time, I thought ECU defensive coordinator Blake Harrell's kind of unique 3-3-5 stack. Look, although I don't know, a lot of people run a 3-3-5 stack at this point. So anyway, setting aside how unique it is or isn't, but it was a look that definitely gave the Cougar offense problems when these teams played in Houston last year. And whereas I think we both have a decent idea of what the ECU offense versus UH defense matchup is going to look like, I think the UH offense versus ECU defense matchup is interesting because I think it's a good test, like I said earlier, and I have less of an idea how it will go. I mean, I think if the Cougars win or lose can put up the kind of numbers they've put up recently against this defense, then I don't know, we might actually see the Cougars pull this one out, or a game that is at least competitive enough to be compelling.
Yeah, I think that Houston offense versus ECU defense matchup actually is a really fun one. You kind of mentioned it. The only team all year, and again, you know, conference, non-conference, in 10 games, the only team that scored more than 28 points against ECU was Memphis, who, you know, I guess they had 32 at the end of regulation, but, you know, and then ended up at 45 and the four overtimes. But yeah, man, if the only team that scored more than that's broken 30 on you all year is, you know, 1 out of 10 games, that's a pretty strong defense. You mentioned they've, you know, done really well defense in terms of run defense there. You know, sacks coming from a number of guys, you know, just a bunch of playmakers all over that defensive side of the ball who have been able to create negative plays. And I think it is a really good test for this Cougar offense. I'm not completely, you know, writing this Cougar offense off. They've done some really good things recently, and I think they've given us every reason to think that, you know, I don't think ECU is going to shut them out or anything like that, but it is just hard to see this Houston offense playing against a defense that very much has an idea of who they are and what they want to do, and has had some success, you know, the last three games, holding, you know, UCF to 13, BYU to 24, Cincinnati 27, you know, coming off three, I think, pretty strong performances back-to-back-to-back after, you know, the one kind of bad performance against Memphis. You know, it's really hard to see Houston scoring enough points against this ECU defense to keep up with what I think Holton Ahlers is going to be doing on the other side of the ball. I wish like heck that this is Houston offense versus ECU defense matchup was part of a game that, you know, had more juice to it, had two teams, you know, competing for a spot in the AAC championship, had a matchup on the other side that was equally as intriguing, that was going to make this game a lot of fun to watch. But I guess that's my best advice and kind of my last point here is, if you want to watch this game on Saturday and have a good time, only pay attention when Houston is on offense, and just ignore absolutely the score of the game and any context around the game. And we'll just hope that a week from now we're talking about how we both reversed jinxed U of H into playing its best game of the year by being extremely, extremely down on them.
I thought you were going to do that, reprise that John Belushi quote from Animal House where he says, my advice now is start drinking. If you have a good time watching this one. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I think the Cougar offense can definitely do some good stuff in this one, but it's just hard to talk myself into the Cougars winning what will surely be an emotionally charged senior day for Holton Ahlers and the other guys on that Pirate roster, who I'm sure those guys are itching to get ECU's first head-to-head win in this series in 10 years and send the Cougs off to the Big 12 on a losing note. If the Cougs can pull it off, though, and that's a big if, I think that is a big momentum win, though. I mean, it wouldn't fix all the things that have gone wrong this season, but it would be, I think, a nice statement and a chance to maybe end the season on a regular season, at least on a positive note, the next week, in what should be a pretty winnable home finale against Tulsa. But again, a lot of big ifs there, and I think we've laid out pretty well why it'll be quite difficult for the Cougars to win this one this week in Greenville.
I mean, you get the W there, and all of a sudden you are a very winnable game away from being 8-4 and, you know, being able to say, hey, you know, we had a lot of injuries this year. Our fans kind of bailed on us. It wasn't the season we had, but, you know, even the floor after having a lot of things go wrong was 8-4, which is, you know, of course, famously the record that we fire coaches for at Houston. But, you know, I think would be, you know, again, is the fan base going to be totally bought in going into next year, coming off of 8-4? I don't know, but I, you know, maybe that with the combined excitement of joining the Big 12 gives you a little bit more juice and excitement around this this program that than, you know, currently exists, which is a pretty minimal amount. But I don't know. I don't see it happening, but I always go back to, you know, every time a line seems way off to me and I just feel tempted to put a large amount of money on it, it inevitably goes the other way. So I guess that means Houston will, at the very least, maybe lose by less than 5.5 points. I don't know. I'd like to think that that'll happen. I'd like to think that I'm doing it, but maybe I'm speaking the reverse jinx too much at this point, where I'm undoing it all of its power. I don't know. We'll see. Hopefully, like I said, we can either you know, be pleasantly surprised or be right. So I guess that's the power of being negative, right? You could only be pleasantly surprised or correct.
Yeah, we'd certainly rather be pleasantly surprised than right. And again, big win if you could pull it off. Oh, but yeah. then there's that pesky if there.
All right. So casting our gaze around the rest of college football for this coming week, big game in American Athletic Conference play coming up on Thursday as SMU will be at Tulane. The Green Wave now in a three-way tie for first place in the American Athletic Conference with a single loss, tied with UCF and Cincinnati, SMU and U of H with two losses, I said right there behind them. And, you know, I think it's going to be hard for even a team like SMU to get back into the picture with the two losses. But, you know, you win at Tulane and all of a sudden you're real close there. And, you know, for the Green Wave, it's a chance to, you know, I think more or less, you know, it's a game that they might well need because they're at Cincinnati and the finale of the season. So, you know, if you're Tulane, as much as it was exciting the start to the year, you know, you had that loss at home to UCF, and all of a sudden this kind of becomes a bit of a desperation, because I think if you lose this one, all of a sudden that AAC championship appearance that you've not had and you know, finally had felt like it was kind of in your hands is going to be slipping away. So I think a lot going down, a lot on the line at this game, Yulman Stadium on Thursday evening.
And you get a really good match of that. SMU offense versus the Tulane defense, I think, is a good unit-on-unit matchup there. Tulane has had some recent success, had the three bowl-eligible years in a row under Willie Fritz, which I think was noteworthy there, but weirdly bad head-to-head against the Ponies in a year where I think they've shaken off a lot of historical struggles. I think it would be a monkey off their back to get this win over the Ponies.
And then, you know, another game The Vegas line makes me scratch my head a little bit as we get into Saturday. Really intriguing game at 11 a.m. The only game that I've got in the morning slate that really jumps out at me is number four TCU at Baylor. Again, Vegas sees the Horned Frogs just 2.5-point favorites in this one, maybe indicative of the fact that they haven't really blown too many Big 12 teams out of the water. But, you know, team that's 10-0 coming off the road win in Austin facing a Baylor team that, you know, they were home a week ago too, facing Kansas State and lost 31-3. So a little bit intrigued by the 2.5-point line there. Maybe that's just expecting things to get tougher and tougher as TCU comes towards the end of their regular season, trying to stay undefeated, trying to keep themselves in the playoff picture. But, you know, anytime TCU and Baylor play, you know, there's some of that local juice there, and definitely, you know, awful lot on the line in this one.
I was going to say, Dustin, when you play the rivalry, you just throw the records out the window there. And it's been a pretty exciting rivalry between those two teams since they joined the same conference about 8 or 9 years ago to this point, a game with some genuine juice. But, and again, I think it would be peak this game for TCU to have gotten that emotional win in Austin over the Longhorns and to really be close enough that you could taste it to not just a trip to Fort Worth, but to see yourself as one of the top four teams in the country in the latest CFP ranking, to go from that to losing to Baylor, who's not bad, but it's a kind of Baylor team this year. I think it would be very peak this rivalry. Like, you didn't have much else in the Saturday morning time slot. Navy UCF kicks off at 10 a.m., so that's super for them. There's nothing else I'd recommend about that game. UTSA and Rice, the Owls at 5-5 right now, going for bowl eligibility, playing that game in South Maine on Saturday morning as well. Or Saturday early afternoon, getting into the yeah, not much really in the Saturday morning slate outside of TCU Baylor that we would strongly recommend.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm a little bit worried for Rice in that one. I'd like to see, you know, I think maybe a couple weeks ago would have been more confident. Watching them get plastered by Western Kentucky this past week against the UTSA team that's been really, really strong in Conference USA, I think it's going to be a tough one for Rice there. But then, yeah, getting into the afternoon at the same time, 1 o'clock kickoff as Houston. Definitely another interesting Big 12 game as Kansas State will be at West Virginia, and kind of a little bit of a mirror of the TCU Baylor game, where you've got, you know, TCU's undefeated, but the team that they would face as it stands right now in the Big 12 championship game, the only team with only two losses in Big 12 play besides TCU is K-State. They're on the road at West Virginia. And again, it's a West Virginia team that's been pretty disappointing, but definitely have had some strong performances at home. Just beat Oklahoma at home this past week. You know, beat Baylor at home earlier in the year as well. So, you know, it's again, K-State team that's going to feel like they should be winning, and a, you know, team that is obviously doesn't have the college football playoff on the line, but very much has a Big 12 championship appearance. Obviously not something that you take for granted at a school like Kansas State. Not that they've not had a ton of success or not had any success historically, but I think, you know, it's not a school that expects to go to the Big 12 championship game every year. So definitely, I think, some anxiety facing a game that they feel like they should win. And, you know, getting an up and down Kansas team at home to end the regular season, they know that, you know, they very much have it in their hands to get to that Big 12 championship game. But West Virginia team with nothing really to lose at this point, playing at home, a game that's going to maybe get a little bit uncomfortable there.
Yeah, and they've played a lot of close games on the road. They've had some explosive offensive performances, but I wouldn't say, as a rule, especially with Adrian Martinez's health being kind of questionable these past few weeks, that they're the kind of team that really is a high-powered, explosive offense, which I think makes things a bit scarier. And West Virginia has taken down a couple pretty decent Big 12 teams this season in Morgantown. I think definitely one you're sweating if you're a Kansas fan. The school in Austin goes to Kansas for what would be maybe less of a hilarious win because Kansas is now finally decent, but I would enjoy it no less if the Jayhawks win that one in Lawrence to drop the Longhorns to 6-5. And I'm only mentioning this game because of the trophy, but Iowa and Minnesota play for what I would argue is a top three rivalry trophy in all of college football. Floyd of Rosedale, a giant a pig, which I think is just fantastic and just so Midwest it hurts.
And then getting into the evening slate of games, you know, a couple of, I think, what are going to be fun rivalry games in the 6:30 to 7 o'clock window. You got Bedlam at 6:30, a game with, you know, not maybe a ton riding on it, as I don't think, I guess maybe Oklahoma State could still theoretically play their way into, into the Big 12 title race, but looking pretty down at the end of the year. Oklahoma obviously not having the year that they wanted, but Bedlam, I think, still a fun one. And then a game with a little bit more on the line, you know, UCLA, USC at the Rose Bowl at 7 o'clock, a game that, you know, a little bit shocking with UCLA coming off of that that loss to Arizona, like we mentioned, but two teams very much, you know, trying to keep their Pac-12 title hopes alive. So I think a couple of fun rivalry games in the evening window. And then at late at night, Utah, Oregon, I think is going to be a real fun one as well. A game that we actually miraculously get both USC, UCLA, and Utah, Oregon on games on channels that are not the Pac-12 network. So glad to see the two kind of maybe the two premier regular season Pac-12 games of the regular season, both on actual watchable networks.
Yeah, I would say definitely your best late night bet for football. I'm excited. I will be physically present at Autzen for Utah, Oregon. Was kind of hoping Oregon would pull it out last week. No real bias towards the Ducks, but I was just selfishly hoping that would be in a game that had something close to college football playoff implications. Though, I think this will still feature two good top 25 teams and one of the very best, I think, late night games that we've talked about this season when we kind of do our college football look ahead.
All right, Sam, well, I know you want to get to watch your Running Rebels men's basketball team finish off against Dayton, so I think that's where we're going to go ahead and end this episode while you still got time to go do that. As always, on the way out, we're going to give a huge thank you. Even 90-plus minutes into this episode, we're going to stop and take a minute to say thank you to our Patreon supporters who continue to put money behind the work Sam and I are doing on a regular basis, and that is just tremendously appreciated by Sam and myself. If you do enjoy this podcast, and if you feel like you can afford to put a couple bucks behind it, we would love for you to go to shpodcast.com/support. You will find links to make a recurring monthly donation on Patreon. You can send us a tip one time via PayPal, or you can buy some merchandise with our street sign logo on it. We love hearing from you, listener. You can email us shpodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at shpodcast. And that's going to be absolutely everything for us. So thank you if you made it all the way to the end of this monster of an episode. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in. No cap. 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 No cap.